Hello, everybody. It's the Great Debate.
Yeah, baby.
The Great Debate.
Yes.
Bait me.
We're having a free form today, right?
What does that mean, Healy?
Well, we just sort of have a conversation about what we've been experiencing. I don't know why I'm talking. Dan's the moderator.
We're having a free form today.
Thank
and
you.
What we're going to do is we're just going to have a conversation about what we've been experiencing.
Oh, okay.
Mm.
And you never know, like, sometimes when we're having a lively conversation, that generates some conflict, which then leads to a debate topic, and then I kind of repeat it into the microphone, and then there we go.
And then there's a debate is born. But also possible we won't get there.
That's fine.
So I've been reading this book by Jim Webb, former Senator Jim Webb, who's been running for president.
He just dropped out, right?
He's out. And
he gone.
He gone. Tom Wolfe is where I heard of this book.
Tom Wolfe's the author,
is like, check out, if you want to understand America, you got to read Jim Webb's book, Born Fighting, How the Scots-Irish Shaped America.
Okay.
And
is this nonfiction or fiction?
Nonfiction book. And basically, Jim Webb is like, if you don't know anything about him, he's a Marine in Vietnam. He's a really surly, like, fightery kind of guy. And he's really into the Scotch-Irish, who are people who were, like, from Scotland that in the 1600s moved to Northern Ireland and then ended up in America. And, like, they're into fighting and barbecue and country music. That whole scene is okay. Scots-Irish. If your name is Alan Jackson, Toby Keith, you're probably Scots-Irish. And he talks about how these guys are the backbone of the military. And also he talks about how, you know, we talk about white people and white privilege, whatever. These guys, they're resentful of other white people. There's nothing Jim Webb hates more than, like, Harvard assholes like us. He over and over again in the book, he talks about how much he hates Hollywood and how they're always putting down these Appalachian Scots-Irish type people. There's a good story, though, in the book that sort of, I think you don't need to read the book if I just tell you this story.
Let's hear it.
He's talking about his favorite uncle.
Okay.
Thinking of the Scots-Irish, he says, I can't help but remember a favorite uncle, a man of fearsome but unpolished intellect, who in his youth was known both for an uncanny mechanical aptitude and for his ability to fight. In the ring, he fought professionally. Outside of it, despite being only 5'7" tall, he became a local legend for, among other things, having fought and beaten 3 grown men at the same time. Another fight over a woman ended with a knife thrust deep in his chest, missing his heart by less than an inch. Having never gone beyond grade school, he spent his entire life working with his hands, first in the meatpacking houses of St. Joe, Missouri, then as an electrician, then in the shipyards of Long Beach, finally making an independent living as a TV repairman and fixing air conditioners. He was also deeply emotional. When my father shipped out for World War II, my uncle Tommy Lee Webb took a train ride nonstop from Long Beach to the Midwest, 36 hours each way over a single weekend, just to have a cup of coffee with him. He shook his younger brother's hand, gave him a survival knife that had been handmade by another brother, and on Monday morning was back at work at the shipyard. When I was in my teens, I asked Uncle Tommy what he considered to be his proudest accomplishment. He thought about it for a second, then he grinned. I never kissed the ass of any man.
There you go. Wow, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
Have you kissed the ass of any man?
I've come a lot closer than Uncle Tommy did.
I'd like to imagine the journey from, you know, St. Joe to the ports of Long Beach.
Yeah.
For work.
Yeah.
A trek for work.
A trek.
My grandfather went around looking for work most
really?
Of his life. And then so the family, you know, went from place to place.
Where'd
he would go out, you know, a few months before from Sioux City, Iowa to Colorado, and then from Colorado to Yuba City, California, and then, oh, yeah, there's work here, and then come on out.
That's great.
An American story.
Grapes of wrath shit going on.
Yeah.
What? No?
I said, yeah.
Oh, but then you made a gesture that the listeners can't see where you were like, it was that gesture of like, sort of.
That was me restraining myself from telling a different long story.
Good restraint.
Yeah.
Here's what I know about Jim Webb. So you mentioned that you were going to read a Jim Webb passage, and I was like, oh, I assume it's going to be the erotic fiction that he wrote.
Didn't even know about that.
So here's what I know. He's written some novels in addition to his nonfiction stuff. So far, a debate is yet to emerge, and that's okay. When he was running for Senate, I believe his opponent, George Allen, Like
Doug he was the guy who was like, "Hey, here's Mustafa over here." Remember that?
He's called him
Malaka, something like
Macaca.
That. Macaca, yeah.
Can't do that. No. And but here's what. So he, but the George Allen publicized the writings of Jim Webb in his fiction and was like, "This guy's a. You have to read these things. He's a pervert or whatever."
Okay.
Here's the money quote from Jim Webb's fiction. He's talking about a character. He's writing about a character named Fogarty. Fogarty watched a naked young stripper do the splits over a banana. She stood back up, her face smiling proudly and her round breasts glistening from a spotlight in the dim bar, and left the banana on the bar cut in four equal sections by the muscles of her vagina.
That's it?
Yeah.
Not that sexy.
The mini sides of Jim Webb.
That's just descriptive.
Well, it's, I don't know if it's sexy, but it's certainly like, it's out for. It's not the kind of thing you expect from a person running for Senate.
Well, he's a warrior poet, you know. Like he wrote these.
Look, I'm.
His books are considered pretty good, right?
Yeah, I absolutely defend his right to write that. Yeah. I'm just.
I think every candidate for office should have to write a little bit of erotica and present it to the voters.
And I think everyone would agree with that.
So no debate there.
Approachable. It's like having a beer with everybody.
Have you ever written any erotica? Tried your hand at that?
Yes. No. Have you?
Sure.
Is this real?
Yeah, of course. I'm a writer. I try all kinds of stuff. There's sex scene in my novel. There's all kinds of stuff.
Well, I know there's like, okay, so your character has sex in your novel, but like, have you sat down at your computer and been like, I'm going to write erotica?
I've sat down and been like, let me see if I can write something that would give a person an erection.
You basically. Have?
Of course.
Did it give you an erection?
Yeah.
Was it weird?
No.
What happened? Well, tell us. What did you write?
It was kind of, it was actually like, I may finish this project at some time. It was like a novel about a guy who, he's a lawyer and he's telling this story about like a billionaire that he represented who it turned out had the woman that he'd married was from a secret society of prostitutes that was designed to like extract wealth for the secret society. Right.
Okay.
So it's, that's he's cool. talking about the hot chick that this guy lured this guy into the trap that led to his doom. Sound interesting?
It sort of sounds like Project Greenlight.
What? How so?
The subject of the movie, you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, the Leisure Class.
The
right.
Leisure Class coming November 2nd to HBO.
It may have come by the time this debate is live. Yeah.
You may have come by
thank
the time.
You.
Hey.
Thank you.
Okay.
Okay. Project Greenlight, Jim Webb, erotica. Anything coming to mind?
I think, guys, you're trying too hard to
get
to a
debate.
No, you
might be right. I'm sorry.
What's been going on in your life, Dave? Well, what are you reading?
I'm currently reading Champagne Supernovas, the story of Mark Jacobs.
Yes. Way to go.
Alexander McQueen and Kate Moss.
Tell about this book.
Well, it's great. I mean, you just learn, you know, it's basically about fashion in the 90s.
You're not selling this book at all. You're sucking.
You sell the book. You've read most of it.
Well, I got sold on the book by a guy who told me about the book, Reed.
Yeah.
He's a bro. You wouldn't think this at all, but he's like, I'm super into it. You got to read this book, man. It's amazing. Alexander McQueen, right? Yeah. Everybody's heard of him, fashion designer.
Yeah.
Real name was Lee McQueen.
Right.
He was just a punk kid from the slums.
Yes.
But he was gay. Like, his dad was like a taxi driver. He was from shithole London. And he was just crazy. Just conned his way into the London fashion school. I forget, Central St. Martin's or whatever. Puts on a show that's all about murdered prostitutes and stuff. And a crazy aristocrat who runs Givenchy, right? It was Givenchy.
Well, eventually like Givenchy gave him a job. But the aristocrat who was sort of his patron helped sort of like fund his early efforts.
She's like, this is what we need. Outrageous, brazen style. And she's like, what's your name? Lee McQueen. You can't be called Lee McQueen if you're going to be in fashion. Well, my mother gave me that name. I'm not changing my name. What's your middle name? Your mother gave you your middle name, right? Alexander. You're Alexander McQueen. And then he was like, he went to the brand and he was like, listen, you guys make you make amazing dresses, amazing shoes. Don't change a thing. All we're going to do is we're going to get this crazy bitch I know named Kate Moss. We're going to give her a real black eye, put her in a bathtub and a bottle of champagne passed out in your dresses and shoes and show everybody this awesome shit in a whole new way. Right?
That's not how I would recap the book. My understanding of it is that concurrently, Kate Moss was a sort of like gawky, skinny girl who became embraced by a small, small little universe of fashion magazines in England. And there was a woman named Corinne Day who was her photographer who sort of brought her into prominence. And that it wasn't Alexander McQueen who was like, I'm going to put Kate Moss in these things. Kate Moss had already risen to prominence as the sort of like new face of fashion. She stood for everything that the old guard of the 80s was not.
Right. The old guard was like big athletic.
Yeah, I didn't really realize this, but in the 80s, Linda Evangelista, yeah. Cindy Crawford, the author uses the word Amazonian at least four times to describe the sort of standard of beauty of the 80s. And Kate Moss was like embarrassed that her breasts were small and her legs were short. She didn't think she was classically pretty. But for some, the 20 something year olds who at Calvin Klein were obsessed with her. And Calvin Klein, for whatever reason, trusted these young kids. He was like, I know my brand is becoming outdated, and I just got to trust these kids that they know what's up. And the kids were like, Kate Moss needs to be the face of your clothing. And he was like, all right, I'll give it a try. And they put her in an ad with Marky Mark, and it took off. He was like, okay, we'll have a sure thing in here. We'll have this guy Marky Mark. And ads became huge.
Yeah.
And then they realized, like, it's not Marky Mark that's making this happen. It's Kate Moss. They got rid of Marky Mark. And then Kate Moss happened, sort of exploded. And then Heroin Chic became, you know, sort of thing that people loved for 2 years. And then there was a backlash against that.
Do you think Kate Moss, like, wishes she had a Marky Mark kind of career? Or is she happy with...
Well, that part of the book is about Kate Moss being sort of like just a nonstop party girl. Oh, one of the more scandalous things I didn't know is that Kate Moss had an affair with Jude Law's wife at the time, which is pretty awesome. And she kind of fell in love with Kate Moss, and they called them the Primrose Hill Set, this group of like hot 20-something sort of like druggy bisexual women who were all kind of sleeping with each other. And like a guy from Supergrass was in there, and they were all just sort of fucking and doing drugs. It's amazing.
Leave Dan out of this. Which one of us would do better in the Primrose Set?
Leave Dan out of
Oh, because obviously Dan would be, yeah.
I think it's a tie.
The obvious Great Debates ambassador to Primrose.
It's a tie for we both just are kicked out immediately. I guess it's you. You're like a little bit taller and you're a little more into like doing experimental drugs.
Taller,
and stuff.
You think that's...
It couldn't hurt. I don't know. I mean, I don't think like I don't think they'd be into me at all. I don't know what. I mean, I liked the music a little bit more than I think you did that they were listening to at the time. They were like, it's also in, you know, the sort of Britpop wave of that time was
either
definitely
way,
part of the scene. Justine Frischman was in on the scene.
We're going into Alaska. The Primrose Hill Set is like something of a weird intellectual mascot, right?
We're not going to make it into the inner sanctum of the Primrose Hill Set.
I don't know. You could be better at that because you are quite charming when you turn it on, and like you've got a little gift for that kind of thing.
Am I 2015 Dave or am I 1995 Dave?
Ooh. I don't know.
I don't think either one does very well.
I didn't know 1995 Dave, really.
Yeah, it's a shame.
But I think 2007, Dave, that's what we want.
Yeah, that's the sweet spot. Sweet. Everyone agrees.
What do you think was the best year of your life so far?
That's a good question. 2000, around there, was a great year. That year that we went to Asia, that was really cool.
Oh,
cool. But this year's been a great year, for
cool.
sure.
Great.
Absolutely. I would say, like, you know, around when I was 20-ish, like the last year of college, just because it was so much fun.
Where do you
surrounded
think,
by friends all the time. That was amazing.
How does Great Debates rank for you in your lifetime accomplishments?
Well, you know, it's funny that you say this, because one thing I found is that as much success you have in the sort of like your job, it is always, for me, the side project that provides
totally.
The most yes. absolute, like, so the previous example, this is Fire Joe Morgan, which I did with Yang and Mike Schur and a couple other people. It was really Mike who wrote 85% of it, but just to be part of that, this was a baseball blog that gained some sort of, like, you know, notoriety within very esoteric circles, but it was so much more enjoyable to be part of that than it was to be like writing for a TV show. Even though millions of people were watching a TV show, to have this thing that 8,000
well, died, and
it
you
was
had,
homemade.
Yeah.
It was just us. It was home grassroots. Spun. It was yeah. crazy.
People
have you ever
want
heard
to
of this?
Talk about it?
What's that?
People want to talk.
People want
people
to talk.
Want to talk. There's no insatiable appetite for baseball nerdery, right? Do you think baseball is like on its way out?
It's not doing great, but it's having a little resurgence this year because of the Cubs and the Mets and stuff like that.
I mean, you know, big is it having teams. A real resurgence?
Like, no, it's probably doomed unless they change the rules to some extent, but there's enough like built-in institutionalism of it that I think it'll be okay for a while.
What kind of world do you see for baseball in 50 years?
In 50 years, it'll become more of like a boutique sport. It'll become sort of like a high-income, smaller stadium sport. But if they if they shorten the season, and if they increase offense by like, you know, narrowing the strike zone and some fun stuff, and institute a couple of fun rules, it could be awesome.
Narrowing the strike zone, wouldn't that just lead to way more walks and more boring baseball?
Not necessarily. You just be able. I mean, yes, there'd be more walks, but there'd be more offense. There'd be more runs. You'd be able. It would be more. Anything that's better for the hitters is generally better for viewership. But this is an oversimplification. But
Dan, what do you think? Were we going anywhere? We getting anywhere on this?
Everyone's agreeing with each other too much. Yeah. We're not having a contentious or, you know.
What am I eating here, Medina? These are fantastic.
Pepitas. You're eating pepitas. This is what my rabbit eats for
they're
a snack.
They're pumpkin seeds with what on them?
There's some salt and some flavorings, and maybe they're baked and not really smoked, but definitely roasted.
Can I throw an email out there?
Yeah.
Can we open up the mailbag?
We have to.
We got an email here. My name is Gabe Diamond. I'm a sophomore at Cornell from Long Island.
Hey, Gabe. How you doing?
He says, I just wanted to add my two cents to the Ireland millennial debate. Okay. That was the last time we did a free form. It sprung into this really contentious, great debate about Ireland versus millennials. I mean, it was great. He says, it's incredibly important to note the accomplishments of William S. Gossett, a scientist.
It is?
Hear him out. A scientist, statistician, and brewmaster at Guinness.
Brewmaster.
He revolutionized our understanding of sampling distributions and industrial research. Without the research he did at Guinness and the work of other people at the brewery, companies today would have a far weaker understanding of R&D, quality assurance, production data. Guinness, in their statistical quest, also revolutionized record keeping, the Guinness Book of World Records. We may not know how many successful people 25 and under are, or how many awards Taylor Swift has won without Guinness's emphasis on record keeping.
Wow.
Okay.
I thought that was a great piece of information. Thanks, Gabe, for sending that in.
Gabe, way to go.
You love little pieces of information.
I love little nuggets. So do you, right?
Yeah. I had a great uncle, Abe.
Hmm.
His name was Abe Feldman. Mm-hmm. He's the most Jewish man ever. And he was married to my great aunt, Becky. And he literally carried around index cards with interesting facts on them. And he would pull them out of his inner breast pocket and read them to you.
Like he would write them down.
Yes.
And
but this is before the internet. I mean, he passed away many years ago.
Would he go to the library?
And things would come up in conversation and he'd write them down. Or he'd hear them on the news or anything. Or he'd read them in the newspaper or whatever. Or maybe he did go to the library. I don't know.
How about this? Do you think you should, let's say you're invited to a dinner party.
Mm-hmm.
Should you go to the dinner party with something to offer conversationally?
Should you prepare? Yeah.
Or should you just flow?
No, you just flow.
Yeah. I think if you prepare, it never really works out.
It feels off, right?
Mm-hmm. Have you prepared something for this dinner party of ideas?
You always prepare for host chat and that kind of works.
I've done more and more of that and I'm not sure it's good. I don't know. The spontaneity might be good.
Did you like when Hillary Clinton said that her campaign was going to be more spontaneous?
No. Did she really say that?
Yeah.
What do you think it would be like if Hillary Clinton wrote some erotic fiction?
Mm. I think it'd be all about Huma.
You've got to imagine Huma plays a role.
A lot of Huma.
Should we debate about whether or not Hillary Clinton should write some erotic fiction?
Would it improve? Okay, if some erotic fiction written by Hillary Clinton came out, would it help or hurt her electoral chances?
All right, that's interesting.
Okay. I like it. I'm going to put 3 minutes on the clock.
I'm taking the pro, I guess.
Okay. Should we be a little more specific about what kind of... How about this?
Yeah.
If she...
Okay, what about this? What comes out is an email of her to Bill that's sexually explicit. Am I giving myself too much...
Can I offer a counterpoint?
You may. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What if it's they discover in her emails they discover a draft of erotic Big Bang Theory slash fiction that she's written?
Okay.
All right.
So I'm saying that would help her.
Yeah, you're saying that would help her campaign.
Yeah, it would.
All right. Well, let's go.
It would help Hillary Clinton's campaign if an email was discovered on her server that was...
Well, actually, Dave said it's important that it's a draft.
A draft email. A draft email of Big Bang Theory / erotic fiction.
Yes. Erotic / fiction. Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Okay, all right. Go.
Here's what would happen.
Okay.
Laughter, resounding mockery for about a week. Hillary then gets in front of it and she says, yeah, I'm a real person with erotic feelings. I like the Big Bang Theory. I think about Sheldon and, you know, whatever. Is it by / are you specifically meaning gay, or is it like Sheldon and
I don't know,
Penny?
It's Sheldon and Penny. Sheldon and Penny. Yeah, and I she's described some Sheldon and Leonard stuff in there
and
too, I'm guessing.
Big Bang Theory is a hugely popular show.
I'll say.
People would be into it. They would hear about it. They'd be, I imagine Hillary Clinton's erotic fiction would be at a very high level. She's a very smart woman and articulate writer, and she's written several books, and I think that people would find it humanizing. They would really engage with it. I mean, the number one problem Hillary Clinton has is that people think she's like an ambitious, robotic, empty, soulless creation. And I think if they found that she was a human with real erotic feeling, that would really humanize her and allow people to tuck in with her and get in on her campaign.
If you think that the reaction to Hillary Clinton having written Big Bang Theory erotic fiction would only last 1 week,
well, it would be a part of the jokes about
fine.
Yeah, of course it would be part of the jokes about her until she died. Yeah, definitely.
Even if she won, it would be the predominating joke that people made about her until she died.
And you know what she would say to that? Great. At least it's not jokes about, you know, Benghazi or whatever, her adulterous husband.
It immediately... People don't... Okay, her adulterous husband has not been an issue for her. Benghazi...
Are you sure about that? I mean, it may not be something people are comfortable discussing in public, but I think that's a thing that's in bothers people about Hillary Clinton.
Well, it's not something that people are making jokes about, which is your point.
Yeah, okay. That's bad. It's so touchy that people can't even make jokes about it, but it's a queasy thing that people feel about Hillary Clinton.
People do whatever. Let's get past this for a second. Here's the thing. You say it humanizes her. I say it makes her a punchline to the point of not being able to be taken seriously. We're talking about something that would become so, it'd be such the elephant in the room constantly. It would be the only thing that people would be able to see about her. It would reduce her to joke status. She couldn't possibly be taken seriously. Anything that she actually said, if she gives a serious press conference, the only reaction to that is going to be put in terms of Big Bang Theory erotic fiction.
Would definitely be a burden, but she would ultimately move past it and benefit from it.
I'll also say this.
I mean, things this woman has survived are... I mean, there are people out there who think she murdered, you know, what's the guy? The guy
Vince Foster.
There are people every day who accuse her of, you know, they go up to Chelsea Clinton at book readings and are like, your dad is really Webb Hubble. She basically tried to redesign the national healthcare system. It was a disaster.
Are we done? We got to
keep going.
But here's the thing, Healy.
Yeah.
You say that it would humanize her. Hillary Clinton is unhumanizable. In the past...
What's missing is this.
Wrong.
Erotic Big Bang Theory in
2008, a momentous thing happened, which is that Hillary Clinton cried in New Hampshire, and she said, I came here to hear your voice, and I found mine or something. And she cried. She actually didn't cry, but it looked like she cried. And it was my understanding of it from reading Game Changer, Double Down, I forget which one. And people said, here it is. This is it. This is all she needs. She's proven herself to have actual feelings. She's not a robot. She's someone with human emotions. That's the best case scenario of proving yourself to not be a robot. And it didn't work. She lost to a buzzsaw.
I mean, there was a lot more going on in that moment, in that election, that you can't extrapolate from that. But after her reaction to that moment, I remember being struck. But like the next time she gave an appearance, she really leaned into like, I was looking for my voice, and with your help, I found it. She immediately receded to ridiculous inauthenticity. But I think she's learned from 2008. Look at the Hillary you saw in the debates last time.
She was fine. But she hasn't. No. She does not have a good sense of humor. That will be the death of her when it comes to. She will not be able to make fun of this issue enough for it to seem like a human thing. It will seem creepy. It will seem weird. She has a weird laugh when she tries to joke about it. It will not go over well. It will serve as a detriment. It will compound the problem.
She has learned so much since 2008. I mean, she is really getting. Hillary Clinton is very, very close to approaching a real level. The story of Hillary Clinton is that
she doesn't learn. She's too loyal. She's stuck in her ways. That's what everyone who has been close to her and then left her little bubble says about her.
That would be.
She never learns the lessons of the past. That's what everyone. That's the main critique people have of the way she runs campaigns, the way that she governs office.
Listen, the erotic slash fiction would be such a break in the way people think about Hillary Clinton that she would come out. And she would the only way to survive it would be through authenticity, being like, "Yes, I fantasize about Sheldon sexually." And
oh
Penny,
my god!
And I wrote this.
She's instantly not taken. Can you imagine a candidate for president of the United States "Yes, I fantasize about Sheldon"?
I'm going to write her statement.
Oh my god!
Afterwards.
Next week, Jim Parsons is hosting SNL, and it's over, baby.
Here's what she says at her next press conference. She says, "Yes, I have sexual feelings. I'm a sexual animal. There have been a lot of American presidents who were sexual creatures. And this is the way I express it. It's a lot safer than having sex with an intern in the Oval Office."
Yeah. That's what she says?
Yeah.
She gets crazy and real. That's political suicide.
Why?
Because she's acknowledging that her husband was a monster.
She's not. She's saying that this guy did wonders for the country despite his sexual imperfections. I'm going to do wonders for the country despite mine, which are a lot more restrained than what we tolerate from men. And you know what would happen? Women around the country, women are a majority in this country. They're a majority of voters. They would rally around her. Women have some erotica on their laptop?
Hillary already has the female vote, but in large majority. She doesn't need women.
No, that's not true, actually.
It is true. In a general election, it is. She does not need, assuming she gets past the Democratic primary, she does not need women to come to her side. What she needs are men. What she needs are independents and men. She already has she might go from 70 to 80 in the female.
How many men are there who've written slash erotic Big Bang Theory fiction? Millions. I mean, they're going to relate to this woman, understand her so much more. I mean, already what they find about Hillary Clinton is a terrifying, sexless, ambitious.
What you're not realizing, Hillary, is that she's admitted that she was fantasizing about a gay guy, and people are going to have a field day with that. It's going to be
most people in America don't think about Jim Parsons' sexuality. That's what they like about him.
They don't the subject of erotic fiction about Jim Parsons comes up.
Here's what she does. She appears on SNL with Jim Parsons and Kelly Cuoco. They have a laugh about it. It's a great moment. Everyone's talking about it on Monday morning.
And her numbers go down.
No!
And her numbers
Dave,
go down.
Come on.
Because America
you
says,
know I, just, you
America
know
says I can't take this person seriously.
The debate's
seriously.
Over. It's over.
That's not the person. You know what happens,
the debate's over.
You know what happens? Jim Parsons gets elected president.
We should be so lucky. But, I mean, hey, great job. Spirited debate. I thought you had it there for a while, but... Thank God I found this is what Medina was saying. The guy who finds the image that you, the tactile, tangible thing that you can really lock into, that's how you win the debate.
The SNL monologue.
Yeah.
That was good. Good, Steve.
Thank you.
All right.
Well done, guys. We mined for it. We mined for it and we got one. We had a great topic and it was a spirited debate. We'll see you next time.
Can I just say thanks to all our listeners?
Hey,
thank
listeners.
You so much. Yeah,
thank
we really
you
appreciate
for sticking
it.
With us on a project like
we're
this.
We're having fun and we're so glad that we're giving any kind of entertainment to anybody.
Yeah. You guys are great.
I ran down the road, pants down to my knees, screaming, "Please come help me." That Canadian shaman gave a little too much to me, and I'm writing a novel. Because it's never been done before. First house that I saw, I wrote house up on the door and told the people who live there they had to get out, cause my reality is realer than yours and there's no time in the present. And there's a black dog